Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman.
Cliff Hazel, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
Most fantastic. It's lovely to be here with you.
Delighted to have you, Cliff. I'm really looking forward to hearing all about your history, going right through product, agility, all sorts of stuff. Tech engineering, design, the whole lot. So I'd love to hear all about it. And I believe that your origin in this world was back in South Africa, that you were actually doing some product management over there. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, this is correct, John. I start my story actually in a tiny little town in South Africa that most people probably have never heard of unless they've been there. But this is Grahamstown, and hop, skip and a jump through various product management roles, a couple of telcos there, and then across to Sweden where I am now. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun hanging out, everything from, you know, jumping into boardroom conversations, deciding product launches, acquiring companies. I even spent some time in a call center answering a phone, and quite a while before that, I served my first beer, not knowing how to serve it, and asked the person if they would like ice in it in a restaurant, and got this very, like, what the hell are you doing? Look, I've come a long way since then, luckily. So yeah, plenty of fascinating stories.
You remind me, Cliff, of an executive that I came across a few years ago. He thought he was going to have a very agile day, and he was going to go into a call center and he was going to listen to customers talking. And so he went in and he was all excited because, you know, it's a really good day when you're talking to customers, you know, not just stuck at the whiteboard talking to ourselves. We're actually meeting people. And then he was listening to these calls, and the first call that he heard was this lady said, she rang in and she said, your banking app is telling me that I don't know how to spell my own name. So it kind of went downhill from there. And then there was some builder rang in saying he was on some construction site, and he had only one hand available because the other hand, you know, he was on a scaffolding basically, and they wanted all sorts of codes from him. So he was getting really frustrated on the phone. So after 15 minutes, this poor exec, he just put the headphones on. He said, "Oh my God, like, I thought I was going to have a great day here." And it's like, I'm almost depressed at listening to all these calls. is that good?
Yeah. It definitely teaches you a lot, I think, when you answer calls. It was something that I instituted later on when I was in product management. Because I'd spent time in the call center, I knew how much you kind of get this insight of the real customer-facing issues. And so we actually started having all of the new hires, regardless of where they were in the company, they would do at least a week in the call center. We try to get it going for every year and even a little bit longer if we could. But that, at least that onboarding experience got people a bit of a sense of what it's like to be on the receiving end of a frustrated, confused, or just kind of having some difficult times customers. And so it's, yeah, I think it's very good to have that.
And it must be really useful as well to talk to those people who are taking those calls every day, talking to the supervisors, finding out what the patterns were with customers and so on.
Yeah, I have some interesting stories of one of the things that we did in that space, actually, to try to surface some of the feedback direct from the call center. We can dig into that a little bit if you're interested. So
yeah, I'd love to hear more about that. So basically what you're doing right now is you're helping leaders of scale-ups to basically grow. Essentially, you're helping scale-ups to be more successful. And you're involved in everything. You've been, like you mentioned, being acquired, acquiring other companies, being a product manager, and being in charge of coaches. I'm guessing product coaches and agile coaches and all sorts of other coaches going on. What I hear is that you spent a lot of time at Spotify, and a lot of people find that really, really interesting. Of course, you can't give away all the secrets and so on, but there's lots of juicy stuff. How long were you at Spotify, Cliff?
Yeah, so that was what brought me out to Sweden originally, actually. So it's actually a little bit ago now, but I spent 4.5 years there while the company was growing from 700. Well, we were 700 when I joined, and when I left 4.5 years later, we were 5,000, which is pretty insane. I've not experienced anything quite so crazy before or since. Yeah, I mean, Spotify, especially in the agile and lean worlds, is known pretty well for a number of various things. There's been a lot of hotly debated topics, you know, was there a model, wasn't there a model, did they use it, that kind of thing. And I've shared some thoughts around this a few times, but really I mean, I think the main thing that I find most fascinating about it was the company really wanted, I think, to be able to build something as powerful and as effective as possible for the users. And the hypothesis from many of the senior leadership was essentially that the best way to do this was to create as much transparency and autonomy within the teams so that people can go and use their smart brains to go and figure out how to do that. So the role of leadership, at least in the early days, was very much more around kind of pointing towards a direction of travel and saying, we think we need to invest in this type of technology or go in this kind of direction. You know, something like personalization is a big factor, user experience, the speed of the app, that kind of thing, as well as content and ubiquity. So being on all the platforms, these kind of things. And so if you send smart people off to try to solve these problems, I think you get a very, very interesting set of things that happen without necessarily having to bottleneck on as much leadership approval and handoffs and dependency coordination, because teams are sort of empowered to be able to go and figure things out to some extent for themselves. I'll be honest, it's not all magic and ponies, though. I mean, there's a fair set of challenges. I mean, they wouldn't have needed to hire somebody like me if everything was perfect. Not to sort of toot my own horn, but the job of a coach is to help improve the organization. And if it was perfect, you wouldn't need coaches. So obviously, there were some things that need to be improved. And yeah, happy to share and dig into some of those topics as we go.
Yeah, I'm hearing that like Marty Kagan is hovering up, you know, some patterns in terms of what's happening in very successful companies, and that's kind of embodied in empowered product teams, as far as I understand, not just Spotify, yeah, but lots of other successful organizations. And what he talked about was essentially in each team that there would be, in his world, empowered product team, there would be a product manager, a tech lead, and a design lead, basically, so that the product manager would kind of be on the hook for customer value and business viability, essentially business value as well, not forgetting that we have a business to run as well as serving customers. And then tech leads kind of, can we actually do this? Is it even technically possible? And then a design lead kind of more about, okay, is this going to be usable? Is there going to be friction around this? Is that something that you observed when you were there, that kind of structure?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say probably 90 to 95% of the teams that I worked with, and when I say teams, I mean in Spotify language, we were called squads.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this pattern was also replicated often at the tribe, as it was called at the time, tribe, and even later at the mission, which is the sort of layer above. So essentially directors, VPs, and also inside the team context, very common pattern. There was a lot of variation. I mean, not every team needs a designer or needs maybe a technical person if you're doing something a bit different, but that was a very common pattern from my experience. The one thing that I find interesting about it is I kind of draw it as a Venn diagram where the three things overlap. So there's some kind of common shared experience. And I think often what the challenge that I found was as a coach was that a lot of folks who were coming into the organization, they were used to having a very unique and distinct role. So me as the product owner, I own this stuff. And me as the designer, I own some totally other stuff. And maybe with product and design, they're a bit more used to collaborating, but certainly with tech and product, there was a lot, often this kind of separation of responsibilities or even a handoff. And so kind of conceptually getting folks to build that collaboration so that there is that shared overlap and that they can work in a sort of constructive way together, I think it was profoundly powerful when it worked. It's also very difficult to get three distinctly different people with different ambitions and goals to play nice with each other on a team. But I think it's a lot easier in a context of Spotify where people generally are excited about and want to work together than some of the companies that I've worked with, certainly beforehand, where, you know, maybe everybody's obsessed with their own career goals and incentivized very differently, which can create some challenges.
Yeah, we'll come back to that later on. That's a good point, actually, about culture, because it's all very well to copy what some other company does, but actually, are you trying to solve the same problem and do you have the same setup, actually? And so we're going to dig back into that later on, if that's okay. But I do have something that has been bugging me, because I do love Henrik Kneeberg's video, Product Ownership in a Nutshell video. There's a lovely doodle. I tell a lot of stories about Henrik, about him being a living example of agility in action, where I believe at one point he was planning for 3 days a week, and that allowed the other 2 days for his slack, if you like, because he didn't want to get burnt out and so on.
Mm.
And when he came back from some rest period, he was really in the zone, and he put that, I believe he put together that video together in a day, including jamming the music and so on. And he wrote a book on a plane, I believe, on the way to the US. I really love, I think he's a brilliant guy. I never met him, but I think he's fantastic. But there's one thing that bugs me in the video, and I want to just kind of give you a bit of context about what bugs me. So imagine you have, I don't know, let's say we've got four teams on the same squad, you might call them, on the same tribe, right. I think you might have called it in Spotify. And let's say there's team A, B, C, and D, okay? And let's say team A, they're all good at doing different things, right? They do different parts of the product or whatever. But team A, they're working on the $500 million item. Let's say they're working on DJX, right? They're kind of, they're sorting that one out. They can't afford to move on to the $450 million item because they're working on the $500 million item, okay?
Yeah.
And so there's another gang over here, Team B, and they're working on, you know, what music does Cliff and John like in 2023? So at the end of this year, that wonderful feature, they'll send this out and makes us all excited, you know, the music of 2023, or, you know, you're playing it for a couple of months after the year. But that team, even though it's really, really good, you don't get the value the whole year from that. There's just a temporary lift, maybe for 2 months in Spotify after that. So let's say that feature's worth $100 million.
Okay? Right.
And so they're working on that, and that's fine. And then there's another team, and they're working on some other feature that's, say, worth $5 million. I don't know. I can't even think about one. Maybe, can we make it easier to share my playlist? Because I noticed that if I use the app, I can't share the collaborative playlist. But if I do it on the desktop or the web, it's kind of easier. So they're working on something to do a collaborative playlist so that people can add their songs as long as they've got a Spotify account onto this playlist. And say that's worth, what did I say, $1 million, just say $1 million. And then there's another team D, and they're working on the $500,000 item, okay? So they're all good, really good teams. DJX, $500 million. What's the other gang? The Music of the Year, $100 million. Sure. And then you got your collaborative playlist, I can't remember the number, let's say 1 million, and then the other team, 500,000. So here's the thing, right? When each team has its own backlog, one of the things that happens is, the DJX people do DJX stuff, and the Music of the Year people do the Music of the Year stuff, and the collaborative playlist people on the 1 million, they're thinking of going on to the $700,000 item, but the guy is working on DJX, they can't afford to get onto the $450 million item. So, like, well, a lot of people would say, well, why don't you just have one backlog so we can all bloody see that we should all be working on DJX, you know what I mean? Or maybe on the Music of the Year. We shouldn't be fiddling around with collaborative playlists. We shouldn't be collaborative.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So how did you overcome that? Because that, for me, is like, it can feel efficient for the $500,000 team to focus on what they do and the collaborative playlist, but we're missing a trick, because actually, even though it's less efficient for them to work on DJX because they don't know to do that, it's worth $500 million, right? So $450 million, so surely it's worth the inefficiency to learn, you know what I mean, to
be effective. I totally recognize this challenge. I think it's similar, because I've seen it in a number of companies, and I mean, even at Spotify it would have been the same thing. You've got tech folks working on something, and you've got marketing folks working on something. And quite simply, what you need is, you need to be able to deliver something that needs technical expertise, but the capacity is already full. Well, what do you do about that? The reality is that in some cases, you could teach people from marketing to do technical work. There's probably some things you can delegate, but it's usually not free to teach marketing and tech to do each other's jobs, right? And the same to an extent is true in technology. If you work in back-end systems, you know, if you're an ML engineer, doing front-end stuff might be possible, but perhaps, I don't know, the other way around, and certainly your expertise is not quite the same. So I think people kind of think of software as all sort of the same. And so that's one, perhaps, don't say misconception, but certainly I've seen a number of execs maybe making that mistake, is like, software development is all the same. It's not, firstly. But what I try to do is sort of say, well, if we're doing this work from the top level, and we've got a bunch of, say, $500 million and $400 million and $100 million ideas, what we want to try to do is fill up the company's backlogs at the top level of the company from the top down, right? And I don't mean top down as in necessarily in a hierarchical sense, but basically, like, let's do it from the top of the list down. So let's allocate some people to work on the $400 million and then the $300 million, the $100 million. And then we say, actually, what we've done now is we've filled up 95% of the product development capacity that we want to allocate. we need to slot some other things in around. And I think what needs to happen in this case is that we want to be able to, at the company level, it was, I think Spotify was actually really quite good at this. There was this notion of the company bets. So something that would have been the size of a $500 million idea would have probably, in fact, I would say for sure, have been something on the company bets. And so what would happen is that would be listed at number one, the next one would be number two, and the next one would be number three. And what that would mean quite simply was that if number three was being worked on, and I'm, say, working on that, I need your help, John, and you, I want you to come help me. But you're working on the top thing, number one, the $500 million idea. You're well within your expectation and normal rights to kind of say, dude, sorry, I'm going to stay working on the big thing because that is number one. Please, can you find somebody else or do something else? And so I think with this kind of, I say downward pressure, but having that visibility in the organization of this actually is the number one thing, that changes the entire dynamic potential of the organization. Because if you're not staffing up something that is the number three thing, but you're all working on the number 17 thing, the $200,000 idea, instead of the 70 million example, I'm going to stop throwing numbers around because it gets confusing.
Yeah. I got the idea.
But basically, don't work on 17 if you could be working on three, is kind of the notion. But if you can't work on number three, then find something sensible to do. And for me, the most important thing that I think the company can do is focus on getting that number one, number two, and number three clear, and letting everything else fill in around that. Because if you don't do that, the challenge that I see is the scenario that I described, where, you know, I'm asking you for help and interrupting you while you're busy with the most important thing for the company. I'm less concerned about, you know, if somebody further down the list is, or something further down the list at least, is getting some work on it, so long as people shift their focus upwards to the high level and bigger items that play out. And so that's something that I learned during my time at Spotify. I'd seen it sort of working in a couple of different contexts before, and something that when I work with my clients, and especially when I'm working in the flight devil's world, that's a lot of what I use, is that make a sequence and don't let your number three block your number one. Get that thing clear and you start to see things actually coming out of the organization. Yeah, there's a lot of other things inside there that we could unpack, but I think the piece that it misses in Henrik's video, to sort of tie it back to what your original question was, is that he wasn't necessarily trying to show you a video that was explaining how the entire company worked. And at the point, if I remember correctly, when that video was made, it was not too long after I joined the company. So the technology space was maybe a few hundred people. By the time I left, it was, you know, nearly 2,500 people. I think maybe 1,200 of those in Stockholm alone. That's a totally different scale. And you've got, you know, people managing whole programs of work, whole areas of investment. And so a lot of that, like the top level bets, actually become an investment lever for the senior execs in the organization. They can say, hey, we're going to fund personalization to the tune of X million a year, and that means roughly this amount of headcount, and we're going to fund this other thing to a larger extent or to a smaller extent relatively, and expect that, you know, ramping up of staff and headcount allocations and how people work would probably be somewhat fluid around some of those things. So there would definitely be some movement. You know, the likelihood that $450 million idea is lurking in a backlog behind that one squad who's bottlenecked on something else, I think it would be, I'm not saying it's inconceivable that it happened. I think it definitely did happen at some point. And that's exactly where this bet system came from, was in response to that.
Yeah. And just about bets, right? So what was the attitude to bets? Was it like all small bets, or were there some big bets in there as well?
So commonly people think of it as the big bets. And of course, the big chunks, you know, get into podcasting. I wasn't there at the time, but getting into podcasting would obviously be something that would be explored. And, you know, it's a cross-functional effort across many different functions and departments within the org. You need something at that top level. In Flight Devil's language, I would refer to that as the strategy system, the bets board. So that visualization and that system of communication would have been carrying those items and saying, hey, you know, these are the top things. But there was also a scenario, and I love telling the story. I worked with data infrastructure, and there was, they ran some, it was one squad that built a data storage system. And essentially the entire company was dependent on the store, because everything from analytics data to who played a track to, you know, calculating how much we need to pay artists or anything for that matter about the financials was dependent on this data store. And there was I'll spare you all the details, but that basically there was an issue that if this didn't get fixed, it was likely that that system would fall over. But there's no benefit of throwing more people on it. What they did instead was say that team's work, that squad's work for the next quarter is a company bet. It's currently ranked number 3 across the entire organization. We're not expecting anybody else to work on it actively, but if they come ask for your help and you're not working on one or two, drop what you're doing and help them, because it is business critical. We cannot IPO and we cannot launch if this sort of stuff doesn't get sorted out. And so I think companies often underutilize this sort of technique, because what they do is they focus only on the big pet project of the senior leadership, but actually it can also be used as a lever to drive focus for something that needs to be not distracted from all the way at the bottom of the organization, or something that bubbles up for various other reasons. And I have a couple of other examples of this, but I think that that kind of a lever is often underutilized, as we focus only on the shiny things at the top and not so much the maintenance operational things. And the reason I think that this is so important is that most companies, in my experience, they make money from the things that they built last year, last quarter, last even decade. There's potentially more money that comes from the things we're building that are new, but most of your revenue comes from things you've already built. And we underinvest in those things in the face of kind of shiny stuff and not actually focusing on leveraging the stuff that has already been built. And I think certainly in an engineering space, a lot of people, this really, they feel a lot of pain from that, because they're saying, hey, you know, we don't have time to deal with the technical debt, deal with the maintenance, building tooling, you know, developer experience, platform infrastructure, this kind of stuff that gets neglected in the face of launching that new product. And while I think we need to launch new products, I think it, being able to balance those two is something that I saw. I don't say the company was doing it perfectly, but certainly much better than I think a lot of other companies that I've experienced are doing it. So yeah, powerful tool.
Yeah, I actually noticed some problems recently where I wanted to listen to some music and I wanted it to be a private session.
Yeah.
And of course, in the family, you've got, everybody's using my account, you know, it's all on the TV, it's everywhere, right? And so, you know, we have a family account, they've got 6 of them, basically, but they're all logging into my account because it's easier for them to log into my account, so that's fine. But the thing was, I didn't want anybody to know that I was listening to this music, and it put it into my recents, and it also had this algorithm as well for what they recommend for me. And actually, I noticed that I had to listen to other music for 10 minutes, and then listen to another one for 10 minutes, and eventually it would fill the recent thing, but there was some residue there, I think, from some of the stuff they did before, which kind of was a bit of an annoyance. But yeah, this is an important point, because when we talk about balancing the short term or the long term, we kind of have 4 considerations that we need to worry about. We got, as you mentioned, the stuff that we already built that we're making money from, the new shiny stuff that might make us money but we're not really sure, and then there's how quick can we deliver, because we got competitors, and if we haven't, we will have. And then, of course, what a lot of people forget about is technical capability. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that it's like the engine room for like all your value. And if you underinvest in that year after year after year, eventually you're going to be like Southwest Airlines last year, where they had a big storm and, you know, they had to cancel loads of flights, but they had to cancel way more flights than other airlines because they were doing cut. They weren't focusing on the current customers. They weren't even looking at new things. They weren't looking at speed for sure. And the biggest sin of all, they were actually not only not investing in capability, but they were actually letting it rot, and it collapsed before Christmas in 2022. So it's really crucial, isn't it, to keep that focus and that balance as product leader, to how do you make sure that you're not kind of being kind of almost like a four-legged stool with only one leg, one maybe even no legs, you know?
There was this notion for a while within the company, certainly with a few of the squads that I was working with at the time. Within the tribe, we had this idea that there was like it was 20% time, but it wasn't 20% time in sort of the Google Hack Week kind of way. That was a separate thing that ran independently to kind of, that was more about running sort of innovative ideas and harnessing, you know, novel things that like, let's open the constraints and see what people come up with. And there were tons of great ideas, such as Discover Weekly, that came out of that kind of work. But the idea was basically to say, let's take one day out of the week. So it was sort of, at least notionally, one day of the week would be spent on doing things like fixing that tooling, or like graphing and automating something, or, you know, dealing with squashing some bug that, you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense to put it all on the backlog or whatever, but it's something that if we don't get it and deal with it, it's going to at least grate at somebody or become frustrating over time or compound into a challenge. And I think that's another lever, and sort of to the earlier point of underinvesting in the things we built in the past. And I think that's exactly what you're highlighting. If we don't take the time to put energy into that, it's like taking out a home loan and never paying off, you know, the original debt. You pay the interest constantly, but if you never pay back the house, that interest and that loan is going to continue to grow, and pretty soon you're going to run into a challenge. And so I think there's an amount of that. I mean, there's limits to that metaphor, but I think it's really profoundly important to spend time cleaning house and tidying up and dealing with underlying things, if for no other reason than the cognitive load and psychological benefits that it has on a team when they just get to spring clean every once in a while and go, oh, it feels so much better, you know.
Another one I love as well is your strategy there. Another one I love as well is the Scouts rule or the Girl Guides rule, where you kind of leave the place tidier than you found it. You pick up the feet. There's a book. Let's say I look at my desk here and I'm supposed to work on a keyboard or something, but I notice there's some paper all over the desk and pens and stuff. It doesn't matter if I didn't make the mess. It's a bloody mess, so I need to fix it. So, you know, if I see some mess, I clean it up. As you said, clean up the house, clean up the kitchen. And it makes you slow in the short term, doesn't it? But better in the long term. Of course, if you see something that's going to take you 6 months, you maybe need to talk to your product manager about that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a nice strategy. It's kind of building a habit of quality and capability.
Yeah. So the area that I worked in where we had that, we actually phased it out because the tribe lead, she was fantastic. It's probably still to this day one of the favorite people that I've worked with. She was explaining that the problem with having a single day to do it is that you end up kind of squashing all of that work and kind of cutting corners the rest of the time in order to do it on that one day. And it's kind of deferring your problems into tomorrow. And you see the same thing when people have like a no meeting Wednesday or something. All you do is you just have tons of meetings on Tuesday and Thursday. You don't actually address the issue of meeting overload. And so what she did was she said, well, we need to push firstly to get that Boy Scout rule kind of approach of saying, let's clean up as we're going constantly. And once we get to a place where we're comfortable that we can do that, then we can phase out this dedicated day and spend it on something else. And I think that kind of thinking is a perfect example of sort of a systemic approach to these kind of things, saying like, you know, it's not enough just to decree that the thing is now this way. People really have to get and internalize and shift their behaviors. And that's a huge piece of what I try to help with in the companies that I work with, is that thing of, you know, it's one thing to find the high leverage stuff to work on. It's another to be able to consistently put focus on those items and actually do it at an organizational scale. But you also have to build these habits to maintain consistently that activity and that behavior. And yeah, that's the thing that I find most fascinating. How do you build those habits to be sustainable and long-term effective, rather than just, you know, hitting our goals this quarter, but then things explode 2 months from now when everything falls over because we didn't build it right?
Yeah, and you mentioned that when you started in Spotify, there were a couple hundred people or so in the footprint that you were dealing with, and that kind of blew up very quickly to 2,500. And that's something that a lot of scale-ups struggle with, that period where they go from basically being startup to grown-up. It's a very painful period. And there's a big temptation to specialize into functions. Where, you know, I don't know, I'm just making stuff up here. I don't know. The back-end people have a back-end manager, back-end director, and you get these little empires building. And it's very natural to kind of want to structure it that way because that's the way it was done in the 20th century. What struggles did you notice during scale-up? And looking back now, there would have been some things that maybe you thought we tried that weren't a great idea. And there were some things that actually worked out quite well. Can you tell us a few stories about that, Cliff, without giving any secrets away, company secrets away?
So I think in the early stages, there was this challenge around autonomy and alignment, and I'll name it so that I can come back to it in a second. And then the other piece was this sort of thing of, basically, when you're growing, your model of organization might make sense today. And as it evolves, it perhaps shifts. So a perfect example of this would be the chapter model. For me, one of the biggest benefits of having chapters was that you're my manager today when I start. But because we're hiring so rapidly, by the time we get to the end of the year, I might have moved teams and I'm now working on something else, or the team has grown too big and we've split it into two parts. I can have a consistent managerial relationship so that my performance development and my career path can be supported in a healthy way. So I'm not changing managers every time I change teams. That's super, super helpful when you've got a rapid movement of people between teams and so on. However, that can become a little bit of a painful thing when you've got managers actually matrixed across many parts of the organization. And so what you might end up is from a squad perspective, or an individual perspective, my manager is not on my team. They don't see my work. They're also split across seven other teams. And so for each team, they don't have like a manager or a senior person supporting. And so without a team lead, this can kind of become a little bit of a challenge if you're not investing in really creating some sort of autonomous and kind of group leadership sort of a structure. And so I think a lot of these things are kind of, you know, something that was a great idea at a certain scale or at a certain pace of growth. Once your organization stabilizes and the change rate of change is different, it maybe doesn't make so much sense anymore. And so I question a lot of companies when they're borrowing things from Spotify. I have this story that I tell in one of my talks where I say, like, you have to really think about, like, do you have the same problem that Spotify had when they used that thing? Because it was there for a reason. And it would also, I think, be dangerous to assume not only that it will solve that problem, but that it was a good reason. We might have just thought we had the problem, and then it turned out we didn't have that problem, or the problem was actually something else. And I think the autonomy is another great example of this. In the early stages, I mentioned that we had a lot of freedom to do a lot of things, but as the company grows, the challenge becomes exactly like what you were saying earlier about the $500 million idea. How do we rally a bunch of totally independent groups of people towards something? And I think in the early stages, the company really dialed, I would argue, even too hard on this idea of autonomy and freedom without the counterbalance of any kind of system for real alignment and coherence across the organization. And I think it's fantastic to have autonomy, but autonomy doesn't mean, as I've seen, unfortunately, many leaders do, basically just backing off and leaving the team to do whatever they want. There is a responsibility, as Don Reinertsen says, to not only provide the authority to make good decisions, but also the information that is necessary to make good ones. And I think as leaders, we have a responsibility to work within that context to make sure that people know what their peers are doing and what rules or standards should we actually be agreeing as a common principle across the org. Which ones do we bend? Which ones do we never break? What do we always do? What do we, you know, take very seriously? And where are we allowed to, you know, kind of be a bit more flexible? And so I think all of these things, there's loads of nuance. There's very few things in life, and certainly very few things in a work context, where I see them as absolutes and never changing. I usually find that idea to be somewhat problematic and overly dogmatic, because if you've touched on some of the stuff in Kinevan and complexity, you know, you create that hard boundary, and when it breaks, you fall off the cliff from the clear space into the chaotic, and things just get really, really, really crazy, and it's very expensive to recover.
Yeah. Just on that Kinevan thing as well, another thing that Dave talks about is retrospective coherence, where you kind of look back. And this is the danger, by the way, of hoovering up patterns of successful organizations, because you think, well, I'll just do what they did. If it's good for them, it's good for me. It seems logical. But the problem is that you're kind of assuming that we've got 2020 vision to understand what actually happened. And actually, we're, you know, God love us, we think we're rational, but we're really imitating a lot of the time. And sometimes we can't actually put our finger on what caused what to happen and what actually really. You talked today actually in LinkedIn about, what was it called? Survival bias? What was it called?
Survivorship bias, yeah.
Survivorship bias, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about that actually? Because I found that very interesting.
So there's a couple of fascinating stories, but the simplest way to explain it is that when you look at basically the winners in a situation and you ignore all of the unsuccessful contenders in a scenario. So the story was actually a military one. A bunch of planes came back and they had bullet holes in certain parts of the plane. And so they assumed that, well, planes that got shot in that area were somehow, you know, they were survivors and they were strong. But the reality was that actually it was not about reinforcing those points where they were getting shot. It was about understanding the opposite parts, because if they got shot in, you know, the wing, the plane could still fly and come back. Whereas if you got shot in the pilot or in the fuel tank, the plane didn't make it back. And so there is this selection bias in the data points that we're using. And it's extremely common in a number of things. I would kind of generalize it and say that a very vast majority of business books suffer from exactly that, is people telling you a story about here's what we did and look, we won, therefore it must be that thing that caused the winning. The reality is that there's hundreds if not thousands of other companies who use those exact tools and techniques, and we could have a nuanced debate about how well did they use them. And so that was what I was trying to provoke on LinkedIn today. But they used them and they didn't succeed. And so can you say, well, you know, lean or agile or Toyota's lean manufacturing? Yeah, sure. I think these are helpful techniques, but it's very rare that those are the primary drivers or even the singular drivers, even where they do play a significant role. And so I think it's good to be aware of it and catch ourselves when we're kind of going, well, we should do it because that company did it and they were successful.
Yeah, we're kind of suckers for that as human beings, aren't we? That, you know, one of my friends, he's worth well over a couple of hundred million at this stage, and he talked about, you know, all the things he did to get there. But actually, I know a lot of people who did exactly what he did, and they're not worth 200 million now. You know,
I think it's an interesting thing because I dabble a little bit in trying to understand this, because a piece of my origin story that I didn't get to is that quite early in my career, I was in the boardroom having conversations with a lot of different people. And I don't want to belittle those people because that's not my intent, but I sort of had this idea that everyone who sat in the boardroom was somehow incredibly smart, like genius level. And sitting around listening to the conversations and interacting with these people, I realized that most of them are just normal people. And so this idea that somehow everybody was like super smart was the thing that was the differentiator between extremely successful and not, triggered in my brain. And I realized that it can't be that's causing it. There has to be some other things that are playing a role as well. And I think there's a myriad of factors that play a role, but luck and failure are sort of two sides of that in a way. And I think there's a number of things we can do to increase our luck. Agile and lean experimentation type approaches are great for discovering what works, but they can also help us avoid really dumb and stupid ideas on the other side. And so your friend who's got a bunch of money, chances are they haven't made any monumentally stupid decisions that caused them to lose 99% of what they've built.
Yeah.
And I think that avoiding those failures is often actually a better scenario than trying to necessarily find the best winners. If you place a lot of bets in poker, you know, if you can keep your hand for longer, the more money you have, the more bets you can play, the longer you stay in the game, the more likely you are to win. It's a statistics and probabilistic thing. And I'm sure that some people who have studied probabilistic thinking in more depth than I have would probably unpack some nuance and specifics there. But I think that thing of trying to be able to shut down, and I talk to a lot of the execs that I work with and say, wouldn't you want to know 3 months into a 12-month program that this thing was never going to fly, and be able to shut it down and save 3/4 worth of development time and rather allocate it to something else? And the short answer is very vast majority of people say yes. And of course, there's, you know, there's a whole bunch of complexity around the sort of social system of trying to shut down something that's in flight. But at the very least, if you can prove or get some data that shows, you know, and I think the first part is being open to the fact that there might be, you know, we could learn enough to be able to change our course is a huge part of that. Because if you're not willing to learn, you won't look for the signals that prove you otherwise.
I want to ask you about that, actually, because I did an unintentional experiment last year. It ended up being quite a big experiment. 36 teams at a university.
Yeah,
I was teaching them Lean UX with Joshua's permission. And I had, I don't know, 150 people in the room, 110 people online. I had a really cool mentor of mine working online. He was looking after people online. I was in the room. You know, it was the end of COVID. So last minute, 100 people went onto Zoom. So we were ready for it. We had a plan. It was all good. But it was interesting because we were using Lean UX. And in Lean UX, there isn't a rhythm, if you like, of checking in about, you know, are we on the right track? There is, in a sense, in that you look at the canvas, you know, you do your experiments, you learn, you say. But what was happening was the subject was, how do you get the best out of hybrid learning? So it was kind of an interesting paradox. Mm-hmm. That's what you're doing. But the people say, oh, we're going to use Meta, everything's going to be great. And then when people interviewed each other, there was compelling evidence coming in that people would not use Meta. It was just compelling. It was like, you know, you just give it up, like pivot or stop or something. But 30 of the 36 teams persevered. And I found that really interesting. And David Marquet talks about this. He talks about the red work and the blue work. So the red work is doing the work, and you're kind of, we have a tendency to have what he calls a execution bias. I think you just keep going like hamster in the wheel.
Yeah.
And then the blue work is you kind of step back and reflect. Oh, is this the right problem right now? Have we kind of discovered that we have the wrong goal, things like that? So There are some approaches where you get an approach to do that. Scrum has a sprint review, for example, but there are other ways of doing work where you can check in and so on. So like when you were at Spotify and other companies, how did execs avoid going into that execution bias? Because what you said is quite sensible to me. You know, wouldn't we want to save 75% of the money? But if I was a betting person, I would say 90% of the time, they just proceeded. Well, I'm not saying which company, but that's what I observe a lot of the time. Unless you have some pause moment that's actually deliberately there to say, hang on a second, I think the goalpost might be in the wrong place here. Maybe the money is actually over there, not over here.
The only times I've seen that be possible is when the culture is one where people are enabled to be able to call that kind of stuff out and where the senior execs are specifically open to the idea. I think part of it is that very often what people find, and I'm a natural kind of problem finder. And so when I start working with a new team, I really have to hold back on my kind of, I see problems and I want to highlight them. And I realize that I have to take some time first to build a bit of trust before I can, you know, go in and say, I think I might smell something here and, you know, work with the team on it. But the challenge is that even once you've built the trust, if we're in the middle of doing something and you start being the, oh, but I'm not sure if we're doing the right thing. Should we be doing that? Is this the right way? You get sort of branded as a cynic and a pessimist, and people might start to kick you out the team because, you know, it's detracting from our trying to get this thing done. And I've worked with a number of teams where this was a challenge, and it's really difficult because you end up with these sort of two factions actually fighting each other over this kind of, I can show you evidence why I think this is a silly idea, or, you know, we should actually stop it. And the other who's just trying to drag this thing over the finish line so they can move on to something else, even if they sometimes think that it's a bad idea. I think the only way to tackle that is to have intentional spaces where you can do this. And I think in a lot of the sort of lean design principles, they talk about this idea of the double diamond, where you open and explore ideas and then you converge on the problem space. And then you repeat that with the solution space. So you explore solutions and then you converge on a solution, and using something kind of like a sprint to execute after that, say, well, for a minimum of 2 weeks, we're going to work on this thing and we're going to see what we come back with. And then there's an opportunity to step back and go, are we still going in a sensible direction, or should we change course or even stop entirely and reconsider our plans? But a lot of people don't treat it as that. And I think those kind of ideas of a design or a delivery sprint where you can say, okay, we're not going to entertain 200,000 ideas unless it's so obvious that we should not be doing. The cost or the risk here is 2 weeks worth of our time. And maybe you use a different cadence on a company level. You might use months or quarters, but just to kind of look at something and go, is this actually still moving in the right direction? A big piece of what I try to do with this is trying to get the company to be able to articulate the goals in terms of an outcome that we want to measure. So take your podcast as example. You want to launch this podcast and you've done a couple of episodes. It doesn't make sense that you would necessarily invest for 500 years in order to see the result. The goal is not to launch a podcast. The goal is to have some sort of publicity, some viewership, some listenership, to meet interesting people, all of these kind of things. And so if you just still it down and you say, I want to get 2,000 listeners, how many do you have at any point in time is a measure that would tell you about that outcome. But often what companies do is they measure something based on the percentage of completeness rather than the percentage of the outcome. And I think shifting that conversation, and I think you were referencing Josh Seiden and some of his work in this space. I was listening to a really interesting podcast. He was on Sami Honkanen's The Boss Level podcast couple of years ago now. And he was talking about that difference between outcomes, outputs, and impact as he was making the distinction, because outcomes create impact, and impact is ultimately the thing that we want. And I think a lot of the time we get so obsessed, as you said, just about deliver, 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 deliver. We're stuck in the feature factory or in the build trap, as Melissa Perry calls it. And we end up just shipping the next thing and not actually coming up for air and going, wait a minute. Did we achieve something meaningful with this? What are we doing here? Did we get the result that we wanted?
So, Cliff, I believe after your time at Spotify, you eventually ended up doing some work with Flight Levels for 3 years, I believe. And I'm gathering that when you were at Spotify, you probably had this need to have some kind of portfolio level view of what the hell is going on across the org and what's going on in different product groups. And I'm kind of guessing that squads had their little boards, whether they're in Scrum or Kanban or Chaos, whatever their approach was, they had a board of some sort, right? And then there was some kind of maybe value stream board coordinating how work is on hanging together. But then you had some people worried about their products, some people worried about DJX, right? So they had different views at level two, if you like. Level one would be team level, level kind of coordination level. And then level three is like, as you mentioned, the kind of the bets coming in. Is it really a good time to put that bet in right now? Level two looks a bit jammed, you know, things like that. So what was that the kind of inspiration for you to kind of move into flight levels? Or what was the link up there, Cliff?
So my story with Flight Levels, and specifically with Klaus, who is the co-founder of the Flight Levels Academy, it starts actually before I even went to Spotify. When was this? Probably maybe almost 11 or 12 years ago now. I was working at an insurance company in South Africa, and we basically built what for me was my first flight level system at one of the clients that I was working with there. We got in touch and spent a bunch of time. So Klaus was involved with the company. He was doing some training that was mostly around, still framed as Kanban and change in that space, although the metaphors of flight levels were starting to emerge at this point. We basically built a portfolio system that spanned across, I think it was 9 different squads within that organization, and managed to help them to get a list of 400 projects down to 15 concurrent projects. And at the same time, their lead time went from 36 months, well, 12 to 36 months on average, down to 6 weeks for a project with the same team, the same technology. The only thing that we changed was the fact that people actually had, like, the sequencing I was talking about before. They had a sequence. They knew what the top thing was, and as much effort as possible from those 9 teams went into that top thing, and usually it was done within 6 weeks, and then a new one became number one, and in the meantime everybody else would fill in around. So I was using this kind of thinking before. I used it again at Spotify, and then post Spotify, Klaus, Katrin and myself, we formed the Flight Levels Academy to build on the work that they had already been doing, and we started, you know, building a bunch of community and other course content and like trying to scale it out and spread the good news, if it, as it were, of what we had discovered and what was resonating with people. I've now shifted my focus. I'm still connected to the Flight Levels Academy in a slightly different way. I'm not operationally involved in the company on a day-to-day basis. I'm still teaching flight levels. I run workshops every so often. I use it with every single one of the clients that I'm working with, and I'm pretty confident that that will continue to be the case for the future. I think the metaphors that are inside the idea are so powerful, because so much of what we talk about in the lean and agile space, I find at times challenging, because the whole thing we're talking about is trying to make things better and fast flow. And then we come in with these giant change transformation programs that make me just kind of, because super busy people, here's, you know, 200,000 hours worth of extra work to make a change that is, you know, dubiously coherent before we even started. The preferred approach in a flight levels land is to say, let's find the smallest possible thing that we can change that will have the biggest possible impact. And so you notice this theme, you know, my tagline, find leverage, create focus, build habits. It's really like, it's got the essence of the same thinking. It's just kind of getting a little bit more focused, a little bit more crisp, because I don't want to change 400,000 things. I want to do the smallest amount of work for the biggest amount of impact and then move on to something else. Because if we can cut the 90%, I think the stat was that Adobe talked about, 90% of features that get built don't get used or get used very, very rarely. I'd like to know about those at the very least before we ship them or while we're building them. And certainly, if we don't figure it out before then, to at least cull them from the product shortly afterwards, that we don't have to keep on maintaining and operating them, because that's not a productive way to do things. So does that tie a little bit of the link? It's a long one that is still ongoing.
Yeah, I didn't realize your history was that deep with flight levels. There you go. That's a light bulb for me. And I love that one-liner you had there a while ago. Could you repeat it there again? Find leverage. I think find leverage, create focus and form habits, something like that.
Yeah, find leverage, create focus, and build habits.
That's just really nice. It's a nice little... you're good at these one-liners, and don't let your number three block your number one.
Yeah.
I wonder you're doing well on social media. Not surprised, huh?
I think this is my goal. I realized quite early on in school that I had an ability to take certain things and simplify them with a metaphor for people who were maybe struggling to understand a very complex and difficult concept. And the challenge with any kind of simplifying metaphor is that it does, to some extent, abstract away from the detail and the nuance of the problem. And the art of doing it well, I think, is to be able to keep some of the eloquence and the specificity of what you're trying to be very precise about without losing people in a lot of detail. And so, I write actively on LinkedIn. I've been publishing every day since the beginning of Jan. I've been writing for quite a while before that as well, and trying to hone that craft of expressing not necessarily my own ideas. In many cases, it's taking other ideas that I've learned and things I've discovered along the way and helping other people to use those things in a pragmatic and practical way. by making them simpler and more accessible. And so, yeah, if you're interested, find me on LinkedIn and let's have a chat. So,
yeah, this sounds really cool. And you did say earlier on that you'd had a couple of stories about a call center. So I wonder, is now a good time to kind of bring up one or two of those stories?
Yeah. So back in my product management career, I worked at a telco. And one of the things that I found fascinating was how, again, back to the boardroom conversation that I was talking about, that some of the senior folk in the organization were convinced that when we did something like a strategy workshop where we did a SWOT analysis, and it was the first time that I started to think that, you know, SWOT analysis might be nonsense, because basically on there was a bunch of stuff written like, you know, we've got world-class customer service and all this stuff. And I was mates with some of the people in the call center, and they were telling me this is not the case. And so what we did was we arranged a thing eventually called a product roast. And if you've ever watched like a roast, you know, the roast of Donald Trump or something, which is a very funny one, by the way, basically the idea is we got a bunch of people up in the room. I stood up on stage and people told me all the things that sucked about our product. And there were sort of three stages to doing it. The first round was people kind of not sure if I was going to take it seriously. I was maybe, you know, relatively new at the company. Some of them had probably raised some of the concerns and been batted away before. So they were kind of a little bit reserved and sort of, okay. So what I did with the product team was we went away and we fixed every single one of those problems within the next 2 weeks. Most of them were not super complicated. People struggle with the logout thing. This notification gets popped up. That thing is broken. Just fix the stuff. There we go. It's done. Cool. Then we sat down. We did it again. Now we start to get like people like, oh, wow, you're actually fixing the problems. And so what started to happen was people were like, okay, here's the real stuff. This is the really tricky problems. And they threw a bunch of stuff at us. But what I noticed was the third time we did it, because we were doing it basically once a month, the third time what had happened was that a number of the folks who were working both in the call center and in the sales team, they would ask customers if they had a problem or if they didn't want to buy the product, what would it take to fix this issue for you? And so we were getting that level of feedback and actual insight from real customers about that's the problem over there. This is the stuff on the ground that is affecting real customers. And we found some amazing stuff that was just so blindingly obvious. I mean, we were wondering why no one was using our self-service top-up system. It was a, like, you know, you have to add extra data onto your phone kind of thing. Turns out that, you know, when you run out of data, we kick you off the internet. So it's quite hard to get to a self-service control panel when you're not on the internet. You know, simple things like that, that you can say, well, we can whitelist that URL, you can get around it, now you might be able to top up. And I mean, it was just layers and layers and layers of that, but we managed to reduce the call center load for top-up queries something like 35% within about 6 weeks, just by addressing those kind of challenges. And I think often people kind of go, oh, you know, this is my point about it's always about the new shiny product that we're trying to build out there. Actually, the stuff that you've already built, that stuff could be making you money, and it is making you money, and it could potentially be making you a hell of a lot more money. You go and scratch around, talk to your folks in the call center, you'll find a veritable gold mine of things that you can fix. And suddenly, not just fixing problems that cost you money, but actually revenue driving stuff like this.
That's a brilliant story. I think that roast idea is really good. Could you use that for almost anything, really?
Yeah.
Like, does our transformation suck? How much does whatever we're doing suck? You know what I mean? It's kind of like Ritual Descent that Dave Stoden has. It's kind of similar idea, isn't it?
Yeah. I know of some people who do it I think it's good to create a very sort of safe and trusting space, but they do it actually in a leadership context where they give feedback to each other and sharing with each other, like, what's the one thing that you're doing that's actually holding you back from progressing in your career? Having been a recipient of this once or twice, it's profoundly powerful to know you think I'm doing a bang up job of these 25 things. It's like, yeah, but that one thing there, if you keep doing that, you're never going to get promoted. It's like, that's the thing that I needed to hear. Not all of the, you're doing great at this, doing great. That one point, super, super powerful.
Just on that, right, I want to talk to you about, because earlier on you mentioned about incentives, okay?
Yeah.
And I noticed Dave West did a post today from scrum.org. He's the CEO and product owner and main product owner of scrum.org. And he said, I didn't read the whole thing yet, but basically it says, I actually did read it, but he just kind of skimmed it. Basically it was, has Agile stalled or something like that? And he called out a few things and rang a few bells for me, but I need to spend more time later on to reading it properly. But what kind of came across was that, well, it's not just Agile stalling. There's almost an allergy building up against agile, so strong that it's even affecting agility now. So agility, people would say before, well, it's agile isn't so much a problem. I want agility. I can achieve agility to lean or product management or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's spreading into that world now to the extent that I'm talking now about timely, humane effectiveness rather than agility, because it's like causing such a problem. And it seems to be coming back to a thing, like no matter which one it is, we'll probably pick on the most popular ones on the planet because they're the ones that everybody knows about. But actually, it's a pretty endemic problem across all types of agility, if like an ambidexterity, which is, are we really serious at a higher up level about making this, whatever we're trying to do, better ways of working work? So like you talked about incentives, so individual incentives. So I can train a guy in a team or a gal in a team how to do Kanban, not a problem. But if she's incentivized, not just through her annual performance review, but also if she's been told more or less, written or unwritten, that if she wants to get promoted, she needs to take on more work. I can do all the Kanban training in the world, but we blame managers about giving people too much work. But actually, the person doing the work is going to take on too much work because they want to come in at 7 in the morning, stay till 7 in the evening, take on that extra thing so they get that promotion, and then we're all good. So basically, the systems, the processes, the workflows that we're dealing with a lot of the time are not coherent with the ways of working that you and I would be trying to encourage. And so what I'm curious about is, because you've seen some lesser and better organizations tackle this, what did you notice in, say, the more successful organizations? And also maybe what did you notice in maybe the less successful organizations in this whole area of executive support, if you like, for whatever ways you want to have?
I think the biggest thing for me is the difference between the stated values and what is claimed as the values of the company and what is actually the lived and behaved values of the company. It's extremely easy as any leader in an organization to get up on stage and say that you value diversity, curiosity, learning, speed, all of these things, and then to go out and behave in the exact opposite way. And you know, it's hard. I set New Year's goals every year, and it's usually a couple of weeks into the year before I've thrown away the first few of them. You know, habit change is a difficult thing. But I also think that there's an enormous amount of responsibility. I see people delegating responsibility for culture and all of these kind of things and saying, you know, we're a no toxicity kind of workplace. But then that person who's, you know, a known a-hole gets promoted and invited to all the senior leadership meetings. Like, your actions are speaking far louder than your words. And quite simply, I think a lot of people, certainly my generation and younger, they've just had enough of that. And when people are talking about, you know, hey, you know, how do I get Gen Z to be engaged and I want them to go above and beyond, the reality is that you have to create an environment and pay them so that they feel it's worth going above and beyond. And quite simply, the vast majority of organizations are just not doing that. And so I think people are just kind of looking around and going, well, you know, if you're going to phone it in, why should I do anything more than that, quite frankly? And so I think it's as hard as it is, I say to folks, you know, if you want to look at why the behavior of the organization is the way it is, it's because of how your organizational structure and incentives are working. And you've probably heard the phrasing, you know, every system is perfectly designed for the results it currently produces. If you're producing animosity and frustration, there's probably something in your environment and your behavior that's causing that. If you're causing, seeing demotivation and high churn, similarly, look internally and see what is causing that pattern of behavior. And I think often it's about breaking those habits. And in some cases, acknowledging that you cannot say we value X and then behave as if you don't, and addressing that. Like, I've seen it so many times. And luckily, what I found is that certainly at Spotify, the vast majority of the time, the senior leadership were open to that. If you call them on something and you say, hey, this is the challenge, and I'm curious to know, you know, you said you value diversity, but I'm looking at your board of directors and it's all the old white dudes. I don't know that you value diversity, and I'm going to ask you to give us a little bit more proof than that. And yeah, when those kind of questions came up, they took it seriously and they went and did something about it, as I think every company needs to do. And it needs to be treated as not just a checkbox exercise, but dig deep and understand, why are you saying that you value this thing? Is it something you're really willing to put on the line? Because you can't fight all of the battles, and it's I think far, far, far worse if you say that you value something when you actively are showing that you don't. It would be better if you just pretended or acknowledged the fact, or even just omitted the fact that you don't value those things in most cases.
Yeah, I go along with that. A real litmus test for me would be when people get promoted into management type capacities, or they are maybe get rotated in from some other countries. So there might be some rotation policy where you get experience of the whole company, all the different divisions and so on, so that you get the ideas, you go, you now got the breadth so that you can go high up and so on. But actually what I saw with my own eyes in the last couple of years, one set of teams in particular, where they were the best probably agile team and teams of the whole company. But what happened was they rotated in command and control manager from hell, basically. And so basically what the organization was saying was that we're not serious about agility, because all the progress that we made was completely unraveled within 3 months. I'm not joking. It was just incredible how much they went into reverse. And that for me is a real sign, you know, what kind of people are you promoting? What kind of people are you rotating in? What kind of people are you encouraging in your company? As you talked about the a-holes getting promoted and stuff like that. When I see values written on the wall, it's kind of, I know they're not true. It's kind of like a Premier League football team, you know, chairman saying, oh, I fully support my manager. When you say that, you know, the manager is going to get fired within a couple of days, because you can't say that, really. It just needs to be real. If you're saying it, it's not real. Yeah. It's kind of a paradox, isn't it? It's kind of a tricky one.
I think most of the time, if you were already doing it, then you wouldn't need to say it. And that's the thing that I look for. Can you show me evidence that you're doing this thing? What would it look like if that thing was happening? And so I often talk to people who are interviewing at a company and they say, I've had this really crappy experience at the previous place. You know, how do I make sure that I don't end up at, you know, the same place again? And I actually had a list of questions that I posted on social media on LinkedIn. It was probably in February sometime, I think. But basically, these are the questions that I would ask. And you can pick and choose based on the specific ones. But, you know, how are leadership rewarded and promoted within the organization? Can you give an example of how, you know, toxic behavior has been dealt with in the organization? Because I think to some extent it's inevitable that these kind of things are going to happen. The question is, what do you do when they occur? And if it gets swept under the rug or people get super uncomfortable, that's probably a warning sign for you that these kind of things are probably not that likely to happen. And I think especially for people who are coming from a position, I talk to a lot of women who are saying, well, I'm trying to get promoted in a, you know, senior leadership in technical area of the business. If you're looking around and there aren't any other people who look like you in that organization, that's them showing you that they're not valuing that kind of leadership. And, you know, it may be that you want to take one for the team, so to speak, and say, hey, I'm going to go in and I'm going to have that role, or you're going to accept the first position so that you can pave the way. But that's often a huge challenge. And I think in many cases, there are probably hundreds of people waiting in the wings within that organization who could have already been promoted. And yet now, you know, we're looking outside instead of hiring from within. And so, you know, I advise people to think carefully about that kind of thing when you're entering an organization. If every place has its own problems, no place is going to be perfect, but make sure that you're entering an organization that has the kind of problems that you're either excited about working on or that are acceptable and tolerable and not going to drive you insane.
I've got two questions for you, Cliff. They're unrelated, so sure. Are related, but the first thing is about transparency, right? So a lot of people say that transparency is a really good thing.
Yeah,
I used to read Eckhart Tolle, and he wrote a book called The Power of Now, and I won't bore you with, you know, me trying to read his book and so on, because basically it was about not thinking, and every time I read it I had to think, you know. But he did say something which I found quite wise. He said, what's bad is good and what's good is bad. And so what I'm wondering is, have you seen any dark side to transparency?
I mean, I think there's a dark side to an extent to almost everything. I think part of the challenge is that in most organizations, what they feel like is that a lot of people feel like is that we don't have any visibility into the stuff that we want to see, whether it's, you know, senior execs complaining about the team or the team talking about the strategy and the direction. I think a big part of the challenge is that it's, if you just open everything up and you share everything, it becomes like being on the receiving end of a fire hose. There's just so much noise. And to try to find some way to cut through all of that noise and figure out what's actually important, especially if I am several layers or several steps removed from the context that would be necessary to make sort of coherent sense of it. And so what I think is necessary is and I use this in both directions, for people in a team who want to be better at managing upwards, there is a level of like abstracting away from all of the detail. Don't tell your manager 400,000 things about everything you've done this week. Think about it for a minute and tell them the one thing that they need to know. And I don't know, give them a second piece if they, you know, there's something else that you need to talk about, but really focus it, because they don't have time to deal with all the detail. You deal with the detail, you abstract it up. The same thing happens when we talk about it from the CEO or from the senior leadership down, right? You have to distill something enormously complex like a business model and all of the inner workings of the finances down to the one thing that people can get and go, oh, okay, we're trying to drive signups of users, or we're trying to lower the cost of acquisition. What is the thing that is driving this business? And you don't necessarily have to have a long, elaborate explanation. The important thing is that people understand what it is, and secondarily, that they understand why it is, in my opinion. But without having that kind of level of distilling, structuring it, organizing it, and filtering it, you end up with just this absolute, just like, you know, this vomit of information at you, and you're just like, dude, I don't know what's important in all of this. Could you please make some choices? I talked earlier about this example of sequencing the work. I've heard so many execs say, ah, but we have enough capacity to do all 17 things this quarter. I'm like, I don't care. Can you give me a list that says this one is number one, that one is number two, and that one is number three? And if you can't answer that question, then I do wonder a little bit, what information are you using to make the decisions about why those things are even in or out? Because if you can communicate some level of that, then I can start to say, hey, we've got halfway down this thing and we're starting to wonder if it's going to work. You know, we thought there was a million users on the end of it. The smell is telling us that there's probably only 500. Should we pull the ripcord and abort and go do something else instead? And the more that you can provide that clear context, especially about the top three things, I think that really helps people to make decisions in the detail about why and how and which nuances of this product are actually important to explore.
Yeah, thank you very much. The next question I have is to do with burnout. Burnout is something that we all have to be careful about. It can happen to anyone. It can happen to people who are really fantastic people, but they just kind of take it a bit too far. And sometimes it can knock you out for 2 years. You can struggle to think, and it might just hit you like a bus someday. You might appear fully functional and then it hits you like a bus, and then you're toast for a couple of years. But people come back and so on. Some people actually know they burn out and they just plan to burn out, and they know they've got a recovery period and they come back. But when I talked about what's bad is good and what's good is bad, we all hear about wonderful things, about wonderful companies, about how great things are and so on. But in your experience, how much burnout is out there? Like in the people doing knowledge work, is it a big thing? Let's put it that way. Is it something that you've noticed at all?
I definitely notice it, yes. I don't have hard data and numbers to say, you know, this number or percent or whatever. It's common. I know many people, and I know people at Spotify who burn out. I mean, it's a big company. There's a lot of people. I'm not super surprised, but I do think it is something that is also needs to be taken a lot more seriously. And a lot of cases, I think there's many things that we can do as individuals and leaders within an organizational context to try to catch it before the battery is totally, totally depleted and real, you know, life-threatening problems start to occur as a result. I do find myself quite often wondering why it is that we spend as much time and as much of our energy working as we do. And I'm not trying to say that this necessarily needs to be copied by other people, but since January, I switched to a 4-day working week. And from next year, I'm planning to switch that to 3. And partly that is to constrain myself to really spend my time usefully, but also because I would rather look back at the end of my life and think about all the amazing kayaking I've done and the great friends and relationships that I've built and all of the other things that come with this. And I think there's an enormous amount of productivity that has been squeaked out of our human system and our ability to produce stuff. And yet we've used that just to make arguably a little bit more money. And in some cases, not really for everybody. It's mostly, you know, kind of moved upwards in the food chain. And I think the challenge with that is that if more and more people start to kind of say, actually, I don't think I want to work 5 days a week. I want to work mornings, or I want to work on those days or from this location. And the number of people that I've spoken to over the last few years, especially since and during COVID, who are saying, there's just no way that I'm going to go back into an office again. I'm not going to commute for an hour every day, every in each direction. I'm not going to get on a plane, you know, 14 times a month to go and visit teams in every other country. I'm not going to spend 9 hours a day in Zoom calls only to then, you know, send emails over dinner while my wife and kid are sitting watching TV, wishing they could hang out with me. And I think there are organizations and there are modes of working that don't require that kind of behavior. And I think more and more people are starting to choose that. And I think we will probably see a more significant shift. And I think especially as ownership structures and different forms of running businesses, I own my own company. So, you know, I make decisions obviously in my own interest. I think if everybody owned, you know, a chunk of the organization that they worked for, they would probably make some slightly different decisions about how time and resources and money get allocated. I think we're on the verge of seeing a lot of shift in that regard. I've been reading some fascinating stories about cooperatives and employee-owned companies and all kinds of different collective agreements where people, granted, you know, with the privilege of already having some money in many of those cases already set aside. But I think we will see a rise as we sort of feel the pushback from this kind of very disconnected. And I kind of toggle a little bit or sort of grapple a little bit with this idea, because I think there are pros to capitalism, but I think we're also seeing the opposite end of the pain points and the problems with it. And I don't think we need to throw the entire system out the window. I think there's a case of like finding some variations of this where we can tweak and adjust it. And as you said, be more human and more empathetic about others in that situation. And the first part is to do that for ourselves and recognize that many of the things that I think we get caught up in trying to chase. I mean, I spent months and months and perhaps years of my life chasing career progression and all kinds of different things. And once you get it, you're like, I don't know, was that worth it? Is that what I wanted? Because, you know, there's just another one around the corner. And I think at some level, that shift to focus on, not in a sort of self-helpy kind of way, but like, what's the thing that actually gets you excited in the morning? Is it what you're doing now, or is there something that you could tweak? And maybe you could tweak it a little bit, as I'm doing, do the 4-day week before you feel like, actually, let's throw it all away and do something totally different, retire on a farm, grow potatoes. I don't know. Nothing wrong with doing that. I have friends who've done.
Yeah, I've got a friend who's doing that as well, and really admire for doing that. And also, I think for the organization there's a benefit as well, because when people have time to help each other, time to cooperate, collaborate, time to think, time to be creative, they're just in the zone. And so they're actually probably delivering a lot more value because they're really in the zone. I remember being at a Scrum Day London conference and I was on a panel and I was a bit tired. I remember feeling a bit tired. And somebody asked a question from the audience. And there was a guy, a couple of people down from me in the panel, and he answered the question beautifully. And I thought, oh my God, that guy is in the zone. How do I get myself back in the zone? Because yeah, that's where you want to be. You want to be in the zone, right?
Yeah.
If we can all be like that, I think it really, really helps. It helps us. It helps the organization. And I think everybody wins. So thank you very much for that answer, Cliff. It's been a pleasure having you on the Exagility podcast. Where can people find out more about you and where you're writing and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so the easiest place to find me is on LinkedIn. Just search my name, Cliff Hazel. I also managed to be one of the lucky few who could still find myname.com. So you can also go to cliffhazel.com. And I surprisingly didn't have to pay like $45 million for the domain name, which is a surprising thing. It was available, regular price. So lucky me. Yeah, the best of my writing is on the website. Contact details, everything is all there. And yeah, I love to work with interesting companies that are growing fast, dealing with their scaling challenges, helping them to remove the growth pains. And my speciality or my favorite point is when you're in the sort of 30 to 300 kind of range. I work with companies all the way up to 3,000 in size, but 30 to 300 is kind of a sweet spot. Coaching leaders, coaching teams, and helping you design better organizations. That's my jam. So if it sounds cool, give me a shout.
It sounds really, really cool. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Cliff.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful. Thanks, John.